Welcome to the Stories of School Leadership podcast, inspirational leaders, shared experiences, creating connections. I'm Emma Lurie and thank you for joining me as I share the journey, stories and inspiration of amazing educational leaders from all around the world. This week I'm joined by Kevin Bartle, who is the founder of Mind Your Head, an organisation supporting head teachers and leaders in education at the moment. And Kevin shares with us his vast experience in teaching and leadership. And he talks really openly and honestly about the experience of leading through COVID and the impact of that on himself. And we get into chaos and complexity theory and some really fascinating ideas around what Kevin and I believe we could do to really support leaders in the sector at the moment. So I hope you really enjoy this one. Let's get going. Welcome, Kevin. It's so great to have you. Thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with me to find out a bit more about your educational journey. So can you just share where you are currently and sort of your current things that you're up to?
Okay, thank you. Well, up until September last year, I was head teacher of a school in Northwest London. And when I stopped doing that, I've set up my own company called Mind Your Head Education Consultancy, and just building that up at the minute. Lots of things going on that are quite interesting and different from being at school. And I also work part time 3 days a week for SSAT as a senior education lead.
A very busy man. I can't wait to find out how you got to this place.
Thank you.
So it'd be really fab to hear about your own school experience. Mm-hmm. It's always interesting to find out what people's school experience was like and how in some ways potentially that fed into your journey into education.
I don't know if I'm unusual for teachers and head teachers, but I really had a difficult time at school. I didn't enjoy it at all. I found myself kind of on the outside quite a lot, being bullied when I was at secondary school. And it was really only when I got to university that I started enjoying education. And the reason I got there, I guess, was an English teacher that I had from what we now call year 9 through to year 11, who kind of inspired me, challenged me, made me think a lot. So that was kind of like the bright spot for me. And I suppose it was strange to people who knew me that I ended up back in the classroom for the next 28 years of my life. But I guess it's that moral purpose that a lot of people have when they go into education, of wanting to be the kind of adult for children that you wished you'd had more of when you were at school. So that was kind of my interesting journey. So inspired by one particular figure, but other than that, kind of struggled with education until uni.
Yeah, I think not alone. I've heard lots of people say similar, having similar experiences, that school was difficult in some way and therefore gave them that inspiration that actually it could be different. And lots of people say this one person showed me, or two people, or you know, teachers showed me how things could be different, which is so special, isn't it? It's an amazing thing that we can offer.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about your kind of first steps into teaching and the world of education in terms of employment and what that was like.
Well I fell into it kind of accidentally. So I had a master's degree to study literature with history, but the funding bodies for literature and history said that it was the other funding body that needed to fund it. So I kind of hunted around. I was quite lucky that I ended up at York University doing English, and I had Mary Bousted as my kind of supervisor for English and Jeff Barton as my first head of department. So that kind of gave me kind of a really good insight into what education was all about from people who cared about it deeply. And then I ended up teaching in Hull in two very, very deprived areas of Hull, where we had to face an awful lot of challenges, some of which feel quite resonant actually to what's happening in education now. And it was great, working with students who had a need for good teachers was kind of, you know, really, really important part of who I've been as a teacher, as a senior leader. But also kind of after just 1 year, I managed to secure a second in English role, which I did for a number of years at a few different schools, and kind of like loved being involved in the decision making for the benefit, not just of the kids, but also staff. And I guess kind of got a bit hooked on that. So my progression then to head of department, which was probably an amazing job, although really, really tough. The job that most reminds me of being a head teacher, actually, because you're under pressure from above and below, and you have to navigate that. And then into senior leadership, in part because, I don't know, I felt I could do a good job there. Sometimes because I felt I could do a better job. I struggled with head teachers early on in my career, quite a bit. So again, quite fascinating that I became one. So yeah, that was the progression, really. A sequence of schools gradually moving down south and settling at a wonderfully diverse school in Northwest London, where, you know, the vast majority of kids came from different backgrounds to my own.
Amazing. And did you, you talked a bit about that, and I've chatted to middle leaders for the sessions a lot about that feeling that you've got that pressure from above, you know, you're kind of stretched. Yeah. And that head of department role, tell me a bit more about that and how that's similar to the challenges that you face in headship.
Yeah, I use it quite often, the same metaphor about being stretched. And I think actually at other times it feels like you're squeezed and compressed as well. So there's a real kind of tension that you're navigating there. So as head teacher, it can look like you're the top dog. It can look like you're the place where the buck stops. But of course, you know, you've got governors, you've got, for many head teachers, they've got trust leaders, you've got the government, you've got Ofsted, and you know, that kind of having to, on the one hand, do things in the way that shows vision and direction, and that really sits with what you want to be and what you want to do, whilst at the same time taking pragmatic decisions to make sure that decisions made outside of your kind of purview are done as well as possible, and trying to align those two things as much as possible when sometimes the people above you want more from you that you don't want to do, and sometimes the people below you want more from you that you don't think is right as well. So and then recognizing when those people have a point, you know, that neither being a head of department nor being a head teacher in any position of responsibility for a team, it's not about you alone at all. But at the same time, you are a figurehead in that situation, up there to be shot at, up there to be kind of valued and recognised for the things that you do well.
Yeah, that really resonates. And so what are the sorts of things that helped to manage those two parts? And that, because you are squashed and you're stretched and you're squeezed, there's so it's such a complex, lots of roles in education are complex. Yeah. But you're right, that role of head teacher, certainly there is so much going on, so much to juggle. Mm-hmm. That keeping that balance is really difficult. So what sort of things helped you in your experience?
I think it's the same actually at a lot of different levels in education, that praise doesn't come often, but when it does, it makes a big difference. You know, recognition for things that you've done. Sometimes I remember once, within just a few weeks of starting as a head of department, I had a mutiny on my hands, and one man that I worked with sat down and told me, you know, in quite industrial language, where I was going wrong with things. But being able to hear that, and again, as head, having an open door policy, not just for the people who are there to give you the happy claps, but the people who are there to also tell you when they think you're making a big error, being able to explain that, but also being able to heed kind of good advice from outside and try and change things a bit. And then hopefully the proof of the pudding is that people will look at what you've done and say to you, do you know what, actually, we you know, I'm glad we went there, you know, and particularly if you've managed to take people along with you who were not necessarily with you. So the man I was talking about, you know, when he gave a leaving speech, I think he said something along the lines of, I was the best head of department that he'd ever had. And that meant so much because I knew he meant it. So there's something about that ongoing give and take, which it keeps you going. But there's also then people just taking a moment just to say, you know, thank you for the things you've done. Or even somebody saying something along the lines of, well, I didn't like most of what you did, but you did this all right. You know, it's those little moments, a bit like when one child in your class says, oh, thanks, sir. You know, you really helped me there. And that just will keep you going through the difficult times.
Yeah, holding on to those positives are really important. And I think as leaders, sometimes we don't celebrate those enough. Oh, we were so focused on the next thing, that we sometimes you even hear some of those positives, but you don't really stop to appreciate actually someone is showing you appreciation or gratitude. And sometimes I hear a lot from heads, and I definitely experience this, you don't often get that lots of praise because you are that person. People don't always think you need it. So I guess supporting your team in the way that you're giving them gratitude, but almost saying that it's really helpful for you to hear the positives is really good as well, isn't it?
The job of a head of any team is to appear strong even when you're not. And I think people are appreciating more, A, to see beyond that, but also postholders in those roles are also understanding the importance of vulnerability as well as something that's important to show. But of course, there are limits to both strength and vulnerability and how much you show of it, because if you show too much strength, people can lose sight of you as a human being. And similarly, vulnerability, people can be a little bit mistrustful about whether that's been utilized or whether or not that person is struggling too much. So there's something about trying to do that. But yeah, I agree. I think paying attention to people who do jobs that we recognize are difficult by just taking a moment to say, yeah, thank you for that. You know, and we could all get better at that, I think.
Yeah, especially when things are so busy. So when you mentioned the leaving speech, was that your leaving? He was making a leaving speech about you leaving?
No, that was that was him leaving. Okay. And he'd been a postholder, he'd been head of department.
Yeah.
Which also meant a lot.
I just wonder, because again, I've also been in situations where maybe you haven't heard lots of the positives until somebody moves and then it all comes out and you think, oh, I think that could have been really helpful to hear. You know, I've reflected on sometimes not always doing that. It was like you recognize something when it's gone. So it's a positive one. So I would love to know a bit more about people who maybe have inspired you in your career. So you kind of talked about somebody who at school gave you that inspiration to kind of get into it. And you mentioned a little bit, which I'd love to know about as well. You had tricky experience with heads. So, but let's go on the positives for a while.
Yeah.
Sort of people or things that have inspired you when you were in your leadership positions and headship.
Undoubtedly, you know, I've had a number of head teachers over the years, but there was one woman who inspired me, who was head of a school that was out in Watford. And it was a difficult situation. I've always worked in schools that have challenges because that's just, I don't know, that's just where I want to be, I guess, and also where I want to meet. And she was blunt. She would tell you exactly if things hadn't gone as well as she'd hoped, sort of thing. But she was really focused on the sense of building a community for the sake of children without losing sight of the adults in the process. And that for me has always been, since then, a key driver. I think other heads I've worked for have sometimes lost sight of that. And I think this is quite a big thing in the profession. Heads who see the ends of what we try to do in leading schools and sometimes lose sight. And, you know, I've done that myself, I've no doubt at times. That lose sight of people as the means to those ends and as ends in themselves. So she was just she was just really good at what she did. She was good at securing funding for the school. She was involved and engaged and interested. She gave a sense of purpose and direction, but she didn't try to delimit your own agency as a leader as well. And yeah, she was a fantastic woman.
Always amazing to have people who have, and so all of us have people who've inspired us in both sides, though. The sort of, yes, I definitely want to be like that. And okay, here are some characteristics that I maybe don't want to embody. Correct. So tell me a bit more about kind of your headship and maybe how you came to the decision to step out of headship and what, you know, what was that bit like, that part of your career?
So at my last school, I was in place for 15 years at that school. I started as a deputy head. By the way, when I left the school, I was probably quite low down on the list of length of service at the school. So it was a school that has a real sense of community. Again, something that's important to me. So we'd been through some difficult times. So I started my headship in 2014. And in March 2019, we had a difficult inspection that was surprising to us, but at the same time, you know, one that we accepted the judgment and we went into requires improvement. And so we were then focused very much on rebuilding, getting back to good, moving towards outstanding over time, by improving the provision at the school. And we were half a year into that work when the pandemic hit. And so then it really became a really heavy slog for 4 years until the inspection service came back last January and improved the school's rating. And so kind of all of that together just exhausted me, exhausted my ability to be completely optimistic, because we were dealing with the pandemic then, the post-pandemic, the cost of living crisis, the challenges to families and how those manifest in classrooms, the lack of funding, the support needed by adults in the school, and that became, you know, really, really intense for such a long, long period. And, you know, the loss of holidays because of anticipating when the next bit of information about how to manage the school, the challenges of getting back to a full education when so many people have been off sick, both staff and students. And for a period of time, it was just relentless. And I realized that my school needed somebody with that kind of enthusiasm and energy that I didn't feel I could at that stage provide for the next stage of its journey. So we knew an inspection was coming. We knew that we'd be able to turn it around from where it was in 2019. But I kind of knew from a year out that it would have to be with somebody else, because that community deserved somebody who could take it on its next step.
Thank you so much for your vulnerability. It's really powerful to share that honesty, because I think a lot of leaders, we're naturally, you said you are there to be the pinnacle of the school and the person who's strong and got it all together, and actually it is really powerful to share for really experienced leaders how utterly exhausting leadership can be, and for lots of different reasons. The pandemic, you know, there has been so much certainly over the last few years, but it's a story that we're hearing from lots and lots of leaders. I'd love to hear a bit more about your thoughts on the accountability systems that we have currently. And
I think, where do we start?
We don't have hours and hours, but you know, a bit.
Okay, so here's the thing. So I've been fortunate in my life that I've never encountered strong levels of depression. I've had high levels of anxiety. I've used counselling services to support me through those while I was head teacher. And a big shout out to education support in its provision around that. And I think, you know, school leaders who are having those anxious moments, you know, I would strongly advocate that you seek that support. I think that the issues with the accountability system are very much central to that, and it's a way in which schools are defined. And I think we're seeing a pushback against that at the moment. Obviously, you know, one particular story has been in the news recently, and I think there's a lot of heat coming from that, which hopefully we'll be able to get to see some of the light as well and some of the movement forward about where that is. I think, you know, the accountability system is there for a purpose. I don't think any of us in leadership believe that schools should be unaccountable. I genuinely believe that the authentic accountability of how your families, how your students, how your staff experience what you do is probably a very heavy burden to carry as well. I think a few years ago, Ofsted published Watching the Watchman, and it concluded that it was very difficult for two separate inspectors to make a judgment about the quality of a lesson based upon so many other factors that could come into play, and therefore lack of validity, reliability of judgment making. I don't know if we've taken the same approach to 2 days of four or five inspectors around a school and how those can be, you know, can come to very, very startlingly different conclusions based upon what they see. So at the minute we have an accountability system without support. You know, as a head teacher of a school that God requires improvement judgment, it was really left to us to navigate the next stages of that journey. So my hope is that, as well as talking about things like single word judgments, as well as talking about the intense pressure that goes on leaders and how we create ways to alleviate that, I think there's something about the whole system and how schools that go into measures of any sort, into unfavourable judgments is probably a better way of saying it, how they are supported with their next steps, because I don't think we have a systematic and coherent approach to helping schools and school leaders make their next stage up. You know, and one of the things that I think the whole accountability system is in desperate need of is research and review of whether the accountability system is making a difference, because there isn't any. There's a dearth of research on whether or not it's actually made the system better. And if we had that alongside a supportive framework post-inspection, then we might see things change for the better.
Yeah, a really valid and clear way of summing up, I think. I would completely agree. And you know, you're totally right that the support, as you've mentioned, things like education support and coaching, consultancy, supervision that is out there is so important, because we can talk about the support to improve the school's curriculum or safeguarding or other, but you are also ultimately talking about supporting those staff to be in a position to make those improvements, because, you know, as you said, it's an exhausting place to be. So I've certainly experienced support coming in that is can feel quite, you know, and it's more additional pressure. So it's definitely a balance, isn't it? Yeah. What really struck me when you talked about that accountability for your parents and your children and your community, heads are often in that stretch because you are balancing sometimes quite polar requirements from what the Ofsted accountability framework might look like and what you're supposed to be doing, and some of those pressures around attendance, for example, alongside, you know, families who might want and need and be demanding something quite different. So you're really, yeah, it's a real balance, and it's really challenging, isn't it? So that would be a really great lead in to what you did next. And so what was your step as you decided to move on from headship? Tell me a bit more about that bit.
Okay, so I set up an education consultancy called Mind Your Head. And I guess from the title, it's quite clear. And a lot of thanks have to go to John Thompson, who helped me kind of in thinking about what I wanted to do. I want to support those who lead in schools. I want to provide whatever support and sustenance that would be beneficial to them. And in particular, having spent 6 years studying around organizational and group dynamics, first of all, with a doctorate that I was taking, and then with the Institute of Group Analysis, kind of realization that supervision, reflective supervision, and providing the time and space for school leaders to talk about their work in ways that help them make sense of their work and make sense of themselves as people, as human beings doing that work, became really, really important for me. As I've mentioned, I was fortunate enough to get some counselling at times when I was struggling. But I don't think that's sufficient. That's a little bit like shutting the stable door after the horse is bolted. People who need counselling or therapy, they've reached a point at which there are blockers to them getting their work done. I think most head teachers, most leaders who have particularly demanding roles within schools, they would appreciate better support going in earlier, something beyond appraisal processes and before counselling and therapeutic services, something that helps them make sense of that holistic nature of them as a human being doing work which has an impact on other human beings, and all of the sense of worry, anxiety, guilt, shame, but also joy, love, word that we don't perhaps use enough in education, the way in which those things are part and parcel of the work, and how to make sense of your experiences so that you don't get to the stage where you feel burnt out, where you feel like you can't continue any further.
Yes, you are preaching to the converted. I wholeheartedly agree. So have you found blockers or challenges for heads in and other leaders kind of seeking this support? There's definitely a building culture and normality mm-hmm. around coaching for leaders, I would say, but still there's a long way to go in recognising its true value, I would say, and it becoming accessible for all.
Yeah.
But have you, seen kind of what those blockers and those barriers are? Because I would still say there are so many leaders in schools who are not seeking it or feeling like it's not for them.
Yeah. I think a lot of the barriers are very kind of profession specific. So you take a designated safeguarding lead who's dealing with the real challenges of a family in absolute tatters with a child who has safeguarding needs at the centre of it. And these are the people who will spend more time with that child than anybody else who's sat in a room to discuss that child from other services. And yet the people from other services will have supervision pretty much built into their structures of their professions, and we don't. And actually, supervision for us tends to fall into one of two frames of thinking for educators. Either it's kind of like 1950s factory supervision, somebody watching your work and can feel threatening for that. Or it's equated with therapy and counselling, and that it's somehow removed from work. So we don't have a culture of thinking about supervision because it's not part of our training. It's not part of our induction processes within education. And therefore, people who have achieved well in the profession and moved into significant management positions, they don't see what it can offer to them. So I think culture is huge, but I think you're right, it's starting to change. There's a lot of good work going on, and for the first time we're starting to see people seeing what culture might be able to offer, and then there's the battle of how that would look. I think other than that, kind of more universal blockers would be time. People see an hour and a half at a supervision session as somehow time lost rather than time gained for reflecting and thinking reflexively about your practice. So there's something about shaping that. And then the big one in schools at the minute is funding. So there is now supervision out there that's free to access, but it's kind of limited. You know, it's time limited, it's not in person, and it will, you know, potentially be used by government to serve certain ends. So I think those are the kind of main blockers, culture, time, and finance.
We've certainly got a way to go, haven't we? And in the work that I do, I'm was driven very initially by my early years specialism. And so what really interests me is when I talk to a lot of heads around supervision or coaching potentially for them as leaders, but then digging into finding out what's available for their early years teams, because it's actually statutory in the UK. Yes. Well, in England, it's statutory for all early years teams to access. And again, great practice, often there's loads of great practice in the early years, but those teams are finding it really difficult to understand what it should look like, as all wonderful government documents. It doesn't say very much about it, just says they need to have it regularly, and there's not that guidance. So there's certainly it's out there, but there's gaps in understanding what it needs to be, what it can be. And you're right, that kind of financial, how can we get it going and make it work, and how can it be best used? So yes, we've certainly got a way to go with it.
I think the message, I guess, you know, in difficult times, I think there are probably two key messages for that financial side of things. One is peer group supervision, and because actually you put people together who are facing similar pressures. So, for example, designated safeguarding leads or other people with really quite challenging pastoral roles in a group with others who hold same roles, then a lot of the work can be done by them.
And there's so much power, isn't there, in hearing that somebody else is facing a similar challenge. In my leadership career, the times when I felt most positive maybe about the way forward or most supported was when I thought, oh my gosh, it's not just me feeling this way. So there's definitely a lot of power in seeking and exploring how things can be done in groups or pairs or other.
And I think the other strategy for schools is to grow a culture within their own school of a kind of more supervisory approach to line management and working with others, and using specialists and people who've done the work on the research to help them embed that, because ultimately that would be the best aim. If schools recognized, as I said, that holistic sense of a person who is a professional more fully in the work that they do, then, you know, I think you could build that capacity that way as well. So there's something about that, I think, that we need to continue working with and exploring and developing.
Absolutely. So just before we stop, it would be really great to hear what your, I guess, aspirations are, and potentially we've talked a little bit about what we need to do there in terms of supervision, but what are the other things that you are going to work on or feel that we need to focus on as an education system?
Well, I think related to the interest in supervision, one of the things that is really starting to take off is an understanding that schools are complex, and that, you know, the kind of my doctorate was in complexity and school leadership, and particularly at times of uncertainty, and the recognition of schools as complex systems and processes of communication between people is one that's very dear to my heart. And I think it sits with supervision. The one thing I've always said is that the work of any school leader is people. You can have wonderful plans, wonderful vision documents. You can have wonderful processes within your school, but actually fundamentally, everything that you want to achieve, that's good and ambitious and community oriented and child centered. It has to encounter people and people interacting with each other. And that makes it really, really unpredictable. You know, I mean, everything that you try to do is likely to have some negative consequences for some people, some positive for others, and a mixed bag for most. So paying attention to human relating within organizations, I think is absolutely crucial. And supervision for me is one strand of it, but I think clinical practice, developing the wisdom of school leaders, of understanding both the theoretical content of what their role is, but also the practical elements of it. And I think there's still a way to go in our system at preparing and inducting school leaders so that they are not trying to impose a simplicity of theory onto the complexity of practice.
Yes. I was talking to somebody the other day about complexity theory, and this we were talking about this idea of it being like riding a wave. There's just so much going on. There's all these tides underneath you and you cannot control it. And and that's the point, it's recognition that you are unable to control it. So if you seek to control it, you're just sort of fighting a losing battle. So being able to recognize that, and we talked about this idea of like a surfboard and just needing to sit on top and find a vantage point where you can see what's coming up and recognize that sometimes you absolutely will crash and have to get back up again. And that's part of it. And that idea of, again, there's lots of research coming out, isn't it, around kind of, especially post-COVID, around navigating uncertainty and actually how valuable that is as a skill for our children and young people that are working with, as much as it is our staff, because if we can feel more comfortable in that uncertainty, then we're better set up to manage it. And we hope, something like COVID isn't necessarily going to happen again, but leadership is so complex that things hit us again and again, don't they? You think everything's going to be fine, go into springtime will be really calm. Oh my gosh, no. You just get walloped again, don't you, with next thing. So really fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. It's been really, really interesting.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm loving what you're doing with this series of podcasts. An absolute honor to contribute.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you so much for listening to the Stories of School Leadership podcast. We'd love to know your thoughts on this episode. Get in touch and tell us what you think, and share this episode with colleagues so we can spread the word. If you'd like some support with leadership coaching, supervision or consultancy, you can get in touch with me via the Stories of School Leadership Instagram account, or I'm Emma Lurie on LinkedIn, or you can send me an email. It's info@emmalurie.co.uk. I hope you have a great day, whatever you're up to next, and I can't wait to share the next episode with you. Goodbye.